Welcome to Sundays with the Modern. My name is Erin Starr White, and I'm Assistant Curator of Education for Docent Programs. I'm very glad you're here today. This afternoon, we're privileged to have Dr. Catherine Caesar here to share with us her perspective on our current exhibition, Framing Desire, Photography and Video. Kathy earned a PhD in the history of art from Emory University in 2005. She is assistant professor of art history at the University of Dallas, where she began teaching in 2003. Kathy's research in recent years has focused on the art of the 1960s and 70s, in particular currents in both feminism and conceptual art, and specifically the work of Martha Rosler, Adrian Piper, and Eleanor Anton. The critic Lucy Lepard is central to Kathy's research interests, specifically Lepard's notion of women's conceptualism in her writings and exhibitions. Most recently, Kathy has been investigating the notion of aerial art and Robert Smithson's 1966 project for Dallas-Fort Worth Regional Airport. I think we're in for a real treat this afternoon. Please join me in welcoming Kathy Caesar.
Thank you very much. How does that sound so far here? Okay. I told everybody I tend to yell, so if I sound too loud, you just let me know. So should we just, can we just go upstairs? Okay, get started. Okay. So like I said, I want to sort of introduce some of the themes that I'm going to be talking about in this exhibition. So yeah, feel free to sit down, and then we'll talk about some of the specific works in this, this room, and then we'll move on. First of all, I want to point out that I'm wearing a Barbie watch. So if anybody thinks that's weird, I apologize. I borrowed my daughter's watch because I don't want to go over on time today, and I don't own a watch anymore, only a cell phone. I'm also cold, so if I shiver a little bit, bear with me. Maybe getting into the exhibit will warm me up a little bit. In this exhibition called Framing Desire, which includes photographs and video from the permanent collection here at the Modern, I want to talk about a couple of major themes. I want to talk about the theme of desire, which is highlighted by the exhibition's curator, Framing Desire, the title. But I also want to talk about photography and its ability to change human perception, its ability to allow us to authenticate reality, to authenticate identity, but also its ability to allow us to question reality and ultimately to question identity. Because I'm going to be talking so much about identity, probably the ages or the portraiture, the first two rooms of the exhibition, is where we'll be spending the bulk of our time. But I also want to talk about the rooms or the architectural spaces, because those are the spaces that humans inhabit. And then if we have time to get to some of the scapes, great. Since photography's inception in mid-19th century, it has become commonplace to talk about its relationship to art and its effect upon art, and most specifically, its effect upon painting. So, probably the most common example, the most cliche example that we all know is about Impressionism, right? The Impressionists were influenced by photography. Artists like Edgar Degas, artists like Gustave Caillebotte started cropping their photographs their paintings, because they were looking at photography. The first Impressionist exhibition ever held in 1874 was held in the most famous French photographer Nadar's studio. So it had an indelible effect on painting of, say, the 1870s and forever beyond. Not just in the way the paintings look, though, but also the role of painting. Painting wasn't needed to be so much as of a documentary device. It needed to find another purpose, needed to find other purposes. From the late 19th century until yesterday, people are talking about the death of painting, and that is in part because of the explosion of media-based devices, photography, video, digital art, etc., etc. But there are also critics, this is no original argument. There's plenty of critics that talk about this, that don't just talk about how photography and video have affected art, and maybe painting in particular, but how it's affected the way that we exist in the world, the way that we perceive the world and the way that we perceive ourselves. In the 1970s, there was kind of an explosion of critics that started talking about the rise of photography. Susan Sontag is one. That is from whence the curator got the title Framing Desire, because in her 1973 essay on Plato's Cave, which is in her very important book on photography, critic Susan Sontag talked about the relationship between photography and desire. And when I say photography, I'm also meaning video. I'm just viewing that as an extent of photography. The wall text talks about photography gives us things that we want, things that we desire, things that we might never be able to get, to accumulate. And she brings up, Sontag brings up the idea of the poster on the teenager's wall. They're never going to be friends with those musicians, but they get to look at them in the photograph. They get to be with them. But Susan Sontag also talks about the relationship between photography and power. And she says in that same essay, she says that when we photograph, we appropriate or we borrow the things that we photograph. Now, that seems obvious because we're copying something, right? So we're borrowing from the outside world, whether it's a picture of ourselves or a picture of our friends or a photograph of a landscape or whatever the case may be. She says it's not just about appropriation, it's about gaining power and knowledge. And so one of the things that I started thinking about in reading her essay is, and she goes on to mention this, that when we photograph something, we gain a piece of it. Whether we ever view that photograph or that film or that video again, we gain a piece of it. And the example that always comes to mind is, 25 years ago, I went to Rome and I saw Michelangelo's Pietà in the Vatican. We were just talking about the Vatican. And is it still behind glass? It was behind glass because it had been vandalized a couple of years prior. Well, this was a long time ago that I saw this. And so you know the same thing with seeing the Mona Lisa and things like that. I had to sort of fight my way to the front, especially because I'm short. But the Pietà was absolutely invisible because there were so many people taking flash photography of the Pietà that I couldn't see it. There was just this bounce back of light in my eyes. And so I've always thought about that, and I continue to think about that, especially now because it's become so much more exacerbated that like that in terms of modern life. Why is it that that photograph needs to be taken of the Pietà? Is it to preserve memory? That seems like the obvious thing, right? So that you can look back 50 years from now, you can show your children when they get older that you were able to see the Pietà and that you had this experience. But maybe Sontag might be suggesting you're gaining a piece of that Michelangelo. It becomes a part of you, a part of your experience, a part of your existence. And it becomes a part of kind of the affirmation of yourself. I was there. I did this. I existed. Think about the 21st century and how those things have occurred now. Think about going to a concert. And when you go to a concert now, everybody has a cell phone up in front of their face viewing the concert. It's as if that mediating device of the camera is essential to the actual experience of it. And maybe it's some sort of distancing thing, maybe it's about power, maybe it's about desire, but it's as if in the current age, and this is not a criticism, this is just the way that it is. This is just a new way of seeing, right? Like photography affected the Impressionists and the people of the 19th century. This is a new way of viewing the world, where we have this mediation device between us and an activity. Susan Sontag said in 1973, ultimately, having an experience becomes identical with taking a photograph of it, and participating in a public event comes more and more to be equivalent with looking at it in a photographic form. This was in 1973 that she said that you can no longer have an experience, a true valid experience, without it being recorded in some way. So just take it to the extreme with Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. You know, not only are people sort of documenting, I ate my breakfast, now I'm going to work, so that everybody knows what they're doing, but they're photographing it. So it's as if even the regular common activities of daily life cannot be validated without a photographic documentation of it. And it's almost like a form of self-surveillance, that I can't exist in this world without other people knowing what I'm doing and there being some sort of record of it. Again, I'm not critiquing this. This is the way it is. It's just a new way of seeing the world. And I feel like some of the artists in this exhibition and some of the critics, including Sontag, who talked about photography in the 70s, just were so prescient, you know, just had some sense that this was going to forever change the way that we view the world. I'll skip that part. So let's talk then a little bit about identity. And I want to use three works in this room to talk about the different ways that photography can both validate and authenticate the self and identity, but it can also question and challenge and distance ourselves from traditional notions of identity. So I want to talk about Marina Abramović's work, but at the end, because I don't think that directly relates to what I'm talking about in the beginning. So we have three series in here. First, we have Nicholas Nixon, who has his very famous series of the Brown sisters that he photographed for 40 years. They've very much been in the press lately because the 40th year has occurred. Basically, if you don't know the piece, he started photographing his wife and her three sisters in 1975. That's his wife, second from the right in all of the pictures. They're all in the same order. So this, I believe, is the first photograph, and that's the last one, isn't it? Or the most recent one? So this is an example of those pictures, and it just sort of started out on a whim that he wanted to document the women, and then it became this yearly event. And so there's been a lot of press in the New York Times about these moments, about the photographs. I read in the New York Times something odd, that he was criticized because he was showing too much about family struggles and family dynamics, which I don't really get, but whatever, that's somebody else's opinion. But obviously, in this remarkable way, it shows the process of aging. It does show the relationships between the sisters. It shows the changes in their poses, the changes in the way they dress, the marks in their face, the changes in their expression that maybe mark images of their life. Some of them are pregnant in some of the pictures. I mean, and what family wouldn't want to have these photos? I was just with my three girlfriends who I've been friends with for almost this period of time, and we looked at these pictures together, and I said, why didn't we do this? This is one of the true sort of traditional reasons or motivations for photography, a memento mori, a memory of death, right? This is my life. I can look back on this and document my life. Again, I can show my children, I can show other people, and you have this amazing record of existence, right? Let's compare that to the Thomas Ruth here, roof. That's this photograph right here. Again, portraiture. Now, we don't have four individuals. We have a single, very large portrait of a young woman. It's close enough, it's bright enough that we can read every detail of her face. So is this the same type of documentation? Is this the same type of proof of existence of a life? Is this the same type of sort of individualized portrait? It's big, it's beautiful, it's colorful, she's beautiful, we see all the details of her face. Well, I would argue that it's not. That if we're talking about photography, acknowledging identity, and documenting the existence of one's life and the changes in one life, this reads as much more deadpan, doesn't it? I've read reviews that compare it to a passport photograph. There's no dramatic lighting. Yes, it is the marker of this year in this girl's life. She's not given a first name, etc., etc. We may get into the Dusseldorf photographers if we get kind of far enough into the exhibit. I hope that we do. But Thomas Roof is one of a series of photographers, arguably some of the most important photographers of the 20th and 21st century, that worked at the Dusseldorf Academy with a very famous pair of conceptual photographers named Berndt and Hilla Becker, whom we also have in the Moderns collection. I'm going to try to sort of boil this down quickly, just try to understand what I'm arguing about this piece. But the Beckers are best known for their conceptual photography. It looks nothing like this. They worked in black and white. They worked serially. If you know their work, they took pictures of industrial buildings, water towers, mines, all sorts of different industrial buildings, primarily in Europe. And they are known primarily as conceptual photographers, where they work serially and they wanted to push emotion or expressionism out of their work. By working serially, they attempted to do that. I'm going on a tangent, but Andy Warhol said if you double something, it deadens it. So maybe by doubling something or tripling something or working in a series, you push out emotion, although you can't say that about these, right? But they were working, the Beckers, who taught Roof, started trying to kind of push out this expressionist bent to photography, where you had to capture a romantic moment, right? Where you had to mimic painting. So although we have portraiture here, we don't have images of water towers, right? We have this relatively deadpan expressionless image. So is that about marking a moment in time, or is that sort of about a different thing? I think that these two series and photographs point to very different things. And then the third, I guess my third kind of comparison to that is this film, The Crying Game. Do you guys want to go closer? And then we'll talk about the Abramovic piece. If you haven't seen it, take a minute to look at it. So what is it? What are you seeing? This is by a Mexican artist named Artemio, and it's called The Crying Game. What does it consist of? Lots of crying, right? Or screaming.
But it's taken out of context. We don't
Right. It's clips from movies, right? And my first thing when I saw the piece for the first time was I wrote down every movie I recognized, right? Which is funny because he calls it the crying game, and I sort of made a game of it. So I've got Fatal Attraction, Blade Runner, Talented Mr. Ripley, Gladiator, The Hours. I wanted to see how many I could guess, right, of the crying scenes. There's no sound, okay? So they're even more out of context. So, and it's the crying game, if you remember, it's probably based on the 1992 movie, The Crying Game. But so what do we have here? We have clips from movies of people crying. So it is actors, so it's not real people, who are pretending to cry in their specific films. To me, this represents several layers of removal from reality, right? It's not real people. I mean, they are real people, but they're pretending to cry. Not only that, but it's a series of clips with no sound to even indicate it. So these are little clips taken from movies with larger narratives. We are not privy to those narratives. So not only do we not have real people, we have actors pretending, and we don't have the full narratives. We just have sort of pure crying. And then he splices them together in this serial video. I guess I'm wondering, and I think this is a kind of a crude generalization, but can we say that across this room we have an opposition between an experience that's totally authentic, if there can be such a thing, in 40 years of images of four sisters, right, who are really sisters, who are really being documented, who are being documented by one of the sisters' husbands with all of this intimacy and love, right? We have this romantic memento mori experience. And then we have about five different degrees of removal, where even though we're looking at film/photography, we are denied this sense of authenticity. We are challenged to it, and we are just left with sort of, like Aaron said, kind of an out-of-context experience. Does it elicit emotion? Maybe for some. You know, maybe it'll help you recognize a movie that made you cry once. But otherwise, I think that there's this uncanny ability of photography and video to ironically separate us from the authentic.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't find any information on that. I don't know. Do you remember the narrative of that movie? You know, that's a good point, that it could relate to that fluidity of identity, but that flexibility of identity, you know?
Yeah, and there's a real urgency about convincing the recipient of your masquerade.
Right. And masquerade is something we're going to talk about a lot, I think, in that context. But what Terry's talking about is the crying game is about prisoners being arrested by the IRA, and then the girlfriend of one of the prisoners falls in love with one of the main characters and turns out to be a transgendered person. And so I wonder if those questions of flexibility of sexuality might factor into it. It's an interesting question. Okay, let's talk about the Marina Abramović, which is called Two Lovers. I don't know how this fits into my themes. I will never not talk about Marina Abramović if I'm in the same room with her. This is a series of photographs that she completed based on a performance. She is primarily known as a performance artist. If you know her, you know that she had a 2010 retrospective at the Modern in New York that was very well publicized, where she reenacted some of her performances, most notably one called The Artist is Present, which was also the name of the retrospective exhibition. So this is a work from her from, 20-so years ago. Marina Abramović is known in her performances for her endurance. And when we get to another piece in the show, we're going to talk about endurance and we're going to talk about time. And time as sort of a criterion or a quality or an aspect of photography and video. So this is a piece about time and endurance, but in her earlier work, she was known for endurance, where both physical and emotional endurance, where she would allow herself to be hurt. She would allow the audience to perform various acts on her and be a passive recipient of them. There's a piece where she would brush her hair for hours until it became this very painful act. So she really, in her performance, wanted to push herself bodily, physically, emotionally, and mentally. This piece is about endurance also, because basically what she has done with her partner at the time, whose name is Ulay, who she performed a lot of works with in the 1970s, basically she's walking half of the length of the Great Wall of China. So what happened is, in 1983, she and her partner Ulay decided that they were going to walk the Great Wall of China from opposite ends. She started in the east, he wanted to start in the west in the Gobi Desert, and they were going to meet in the middle. It took 5 years of paperwork and bureaucracy to get the Chinese government to agree to such an act. Okay? I'll explain a little bit more about that, but obviously the piece is about endurance. It took 3 months for them to walk. They walked miles and miles and miles every day. And if you look closely at some of the photographs, it's incredibly arduous walking. She had to prepare herself, again, mentally and physically, for this walk, as did Ulay. The story goes, and maybe there are different versions of this, but the way I understand this piece is that in 1983, when they planned the piece, they were lovers, two lovers. By 88, when the piece came to fruition, they were no longer lovers, but they decided to do the piece anyway. From what I've read, and this was a criticism of the piece was originally meant as this amazing reunion, in the center of the Great Wall of China, and whether there would be a proposal or a reunion or, this amazing romantic embrace after months of exhaustion, whatever. Well, that didn't happen. And again, there's various interpretations of that. So if you see in the final piece, maybe we should walk down to it, and you see she's made little notes and drawings that accompany the photographs. But this is her, you see, in various parts of her journey. She mostly wore red. And actually, she's originally Yugoslavian, and she said she was really kind of horrified by the ugliness of the landscape, which I think is interesting. But here's the moment of meeting between Ulay and Abramović, Abramović being in the red. So, I don't know. What do we think about this? Again, I guess I want to emphasize just from an artistic level that this piece is about endurance and it's about duration. It's about time being a major factor of the piece. Obviously, also, we see kind of the quintessential relationship between performance and photography and video. Photography and video classically being a means to document performance. It isn't always, but oftentimes it is, and here in Marina Abramović's case, it is. I want to mention, something, a video that's kind of gone viral, so many of you may have seen it, but in Marina Abramović's 2010 retrospective, she reenacted this performance, as I said, called The Artist is Present, and you may have seen images or video of it. Basically, she sits at a table for the entire length of the exhibition or the entire time that the museum is open at one end of a table and has an empty chair at the other end of the table. She does not get up for the entire time. She has to prepare herself physically and mentally for the length of the performance. It's about endurance. And then she invites members of the audience, the viewers, to come and sit and look at her. I feel sort of a close kinship to this piece because one of my students reenacted it in one of my classes. We only had an hour. We didn't have the 8 hours or whatever the museum was open, so it was a totally different thing. But one of my students who's very interested in Abramovich sat in the seat and then invited people to come in. And you know, social psychology is a very interesting thing because it probably took 20 minutes for anybody to even, you know, get up the nerve to sit down in the chair and look at my student. But the students had an amazing reaction to it. Some were frightened by it. Some couldn't speak afterwards. If you watch the videos of Abramovich's reenactment of the piece, there are many, many people in tears. Anyway, to make a long story short, or longer at this point, at one point in the performance, Ulay came after years of not seeing Abramovich and sat down in the seat opposite them. And, I mean, talk about romantic. Like, I was talking about the Brown sisters as being sort of romantic in that it is kind of breathtakingly beautiful. And she wasn't supposed to be moving during the performance. She was just supposed to be looking at people with her eyes, but she reached out to him. And anyway, you've got to go Google it if you haven't seen it yet. So there's sort of a recent culmination to this piece. Okay. Do you mind if we go to the next ages room? Let's start over here. In this room, I'm going to try to again make my division between, and it's a very fraught, debatable position. So feel free to challenge me in this. It's just kind of a way of how I thought about dividing up some of the works in this room, which is also based on portraiture. So let's say I'm arguing that photography can be used to affirm identity and visions of the self and existence in the world. And then I'm arguing that it can be used to challenge notions of stable identity. It can be used to challenge notions of the self and one's place in the world. So, again, I'm already arguing against myself, but let's say that these two works or these two artists that are facing one another may be said to fall on the side of proof of existence of oneself and one's world and one's reality. These are works by Larry Clark, who is influential on basically every other artist in this room. This is his first major portfolio. It's from 1971, and it's called Tulsa Portfolio. It's images that he wound up putting into a book, and so these are images that originally appeared within a book format. Larry Clark was kind of an itinerant artist, as they all were in the 60s, moving to New York, moving to LA, you know, kind of post-beat generation, moving around the world, but he's originally from Tulsa. And at some point during his career, he finds himself back in his hometown. He, like many of his friends, became involved in drugs, addiction, prostitution, and what these images show is a reality, but a very seedy reality of this sort of clique that he was involved with in Tulsa. And if you look closely at the images, they're pretty raw. There's a pregnant woman who is injecting herself with drugs. There's an image of a dead baby. There's nudes, again, injecting themselves with heroin. We see guns. We see a woman with her face beaten. Well, this was part of his lived reality. And so, again, maybe if we want to, we can put this on the side of authentic experience, because he is essentially here a documentary photographer. It may be part of his existence or part of his realm, but maybe it's even truer, we could say, because he's not a journalist looking from the outside, but rather within the scene. Not only was he incredibly influential on most of the artists in this room, but also on artists like Nan Golden, again, who are documenting sort of the reality of these parts of society. This work was critically acclaimed, but extremely controversial. I just read that they were not shown in Tulsa. Maybe people didn't want to know this was, and probably still is, a part of this, like any community. But again, so here we have, again, this kind of documentary internal aspect that we have here. On the opposite side of the wall, we have Catherine Opie, who has two individual portraits. These are probably the portraits for what she is most well known, the individualized portraits. In general, she's most known for her images of queer photography, specifically lesbian photography, and again, these are parts of Catherine Opie's own community. She also does a series of self-portraits, but essentially what she's doing is taking pictures of her friends here, and was really kind of revolutionary, again, for showing the reality of queer identity and her lesbian community. Well, then those photographs are next to an image of high school football players in Louisiana. It might be hard to tell the connection. It could be about feminine, you know, playing with femininity / masculinity versus a masculine culture. What Opie says about it is that she is an American photographer. She really emphasizes that she wants to document her American, uniquely American experience. And she's also uniquely interested in community, whether it's her own community of friends, whether it's communities of football teams, whether it's communities of surfers that she photographs. But again, that relationship between Americanness and community, and also identity. So again, can we view these because we have the artist who is viewing or observing or photographing part of her community, just like Larry Clark is, as working on the more authentic side of identity and reality? We can fight about that later. This has nothing to do with the other things that I'm talking about, but this is by Laurie Simmons, who's part of has come to be associated with a group called the Pictures Group that I'm going to talk about in just a minute, a group of photographers that kind of started being known in the late 70s. And this is she works with mannequins and 50s life and that sort of thing, which is a common image. I don't know if you've ever seen Louise Bourgeois' drawing of the woman house. It's called Femme Maison, woman house, which I didn't realize till just the other day means housewife in French. I mean, of course it does. That's what it literally means in English, too, housewife. And femme maison means a woman house. So this is actually a very traditional subject, oddly. And, you know, it's about femininity. It's about women in the domestic space. But I thought Simmons had an interesting quote about it. See if I can find it real fast. She said, in a work like this, she said, I had a sense of the 50s that I knew was both beautiful and lethal at the same time. So take that for what you will. Okay, so let's move on to the other side of my dichotomy. Well, maybe not yet, but on this side of the room. I want to look at these three works by an artist that I call Renike Dijkstra. I might be mispronouncing it. But she's a Dutch artist, a Dutch photographer, and these are from her series of bathers. Um, She takes images of adolescents. That's kind of her, I guess if you could say she is a primary community or age group or type of individuals that she's following, she photographs adolescents. So these are bathers in the Netherlands. Some of these are in Hilton Head, South Carolina, some in Croatia. But she takes, I think one of the beauties of Dykstra's photographs is that she captures those moments of adolescence that I don't know about you, but still give me those like feelings of discomfort. You know, late middle school, 13 years old, your body's becoming strange, boys treat you badly, you know, or whatever the case may be, all that middle school stuff. But just if you look closely, that kind of awkwardness of the changing bodies, and not just that, but standing in a bathing suit, you know, in this photograph, kind of for long periods of time. And she does kind of make them stand for relatively long periods of time because she wants to capture them at that moment where they stop posing and start to sort of assume perhaps a true identity. Dykstra has this amazing video. She does videos also, and the Wachowskis own it. Have any of you ever seen it? It's of a 13, I think she's Dutch, a 13 or 14-year-old girl. It's a video singing a Backstreet Boys song. It's called I Wanna Be With You. And it reminds me of that Phil Collins show at the DMA, The World Won't Listen, where he has lip syncers from Indonesia and Colombia, but that's another story. But it's a little girl, 13 or 14, with big old braces on, lip syncing, you know, in not her native language, but knowing every single word, this, you know, teen pop boy band song. And again, it's gut-wrenching because it's so uncomfortable, and she's adorable, but we remember those moments of our life where we're just sort of in between and kind of figuring out our bodies and all of that sort of thing. So, and then of course, you know, as the curators mentioned with this piece, she's also playing off classical traditions of bathers, Greek and Roman bathers, Renaissance bathers, Picasso's bathers, Cezanne's bathers. So she's also kind of playing into this art historical tradition. Okay. So, now I'm going to move into the challenging of authenticity. So if you buy my generalized argument that the artists in this room that we just looked at are about the documenting of identity, the affirming of identity, the affirming of the self or of others through photography, I would say that everybody else in this room, or at least most other people in this room, are about challenging that identity. Behind you, on these walls, probably the most famous example is Cindy Sherman. We have Debbie Grossman and Maury Mora. Thank you very much. All of these works are about masquerade. I mentioned that Laurie Simmons was she wasn't part of an exhibition. In 1977, there was a crucial exhibition at a place called the Artist Space in Tribeca. Now it's in Soho.